With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us this morning here on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, a look at Huanglong bean disease funding in one of the Farm Bill proposals, but our top story today. It's called the California Ag Labor Relations Voting Choice Act, or CARD Check for short. Director of Labor Affairs with the California Farm Bureau, Brian Little, says California's CARD Check program allows labor unions to petition to unionize a farm operation by collecting signatures on cards or petitions and turning them into the Agricultural Labor Relations Board. If they have enough signatures, the board certifies the labor union.
That's a radically different approach to trying to ascertain the wishes of employees to be represented or not from what we have traditionally had for the last 60 years.
Previously, signing a card would have signified interest in having a secret ballot election, but now those elections are gone, and the simple signature on a card counts as a vote to unionize. I moderated a panel discussion last week in Washington, D.C. on the overall topic of labor, and I asked the panel participants about CARD Check. Here's my question, followed by replies, first from attorney Christy Boswell, who is counsel in the Legislative and Public Policy Group and a member of the Food and Beverage and Agribusiness team at Alston and Byrd Law Firm. Her response is followed by Matt Micah, who is the Vice President of Advocacy and Government Affairs at American Hort.
You mentioned earlier, you talked about the difficulty of keeping up with all the new laws and new regulations and things, and so I'm going to throw one at you. And if we could talk for just a minute, I report in California primarily. So I'd like to see if any of you can comment on California's CARD Check. And for those who don't report in California, which is everybody else in the room, explain a little bit about what that is. But I'm very interested to see if this is a something that we could see move into other states as well, like we often do with the things that start in California.
So the California legislature passed a law that essentially allows for union organization through signature of a union authorization card, commonly referred to as CARD Check. This has invigorated, we'll say, union outreach, especially the UFW, and there has just recently been a farm that has unionized through this card, this new law, this new CARD Check provision. The farm is challenging the results of this, but it essentially, you know, allows a union to just have a signature on this card authorization, and that is sufficient to then. Once they have a majority of the workforce, they can send that over to the California equivalent of the NLRB that authorizes the union organization without having to have some of the more formal requirements, meeting requirements, organization requirements that have traditionally been required under California law. That's the technical side. I'll let you guys talk about what your members are.
So we had a member outside of San Diego this happened to. First off, the law was passed, but there's no rules and regulations. So for instance, once this happens, after 90 days, you're supposed to come up with basically a negotiation between the farmer facility and the union, in this case, usually United Farm Workers. Well, this facility that happened to us, it's past 90 days. They had to hire an attorney who specifically knows this law in California. And they have sent back all their requirements, but United Farm Workers haven't met or said what they need in their 90 days. They are on their third decision. I'm going to get the wrong technical term, but the third time of meeting. And if United Farm Worker or any union had come up with their proposal and the owner, operator, or farmer producer had not, they would get fined. But yet the unions are not getting fined. The only other state that has this right now, I think, is New York. Just passed it, and the other state that's on the list would be Michigan. So any of your larger pro-union states are looking at this. So folks in the Midwest, above the Mason-Dixon line, you're going to see more of this. What happened to our, and this is from, I'm not going to tell you which facility, but what happened was they had a upset worker who had signed a CARD Check. And according to California law, if there is a meeting of the whole facility, this place had 79 employees. So I think it was an HR meeting where they were going over safety and stuff. Well, because that person was at there, they were able to file a petition to unionize. No one else complained, one person. And so they're going through the process. And right now they're in their third, I guess, negotiation of what that contract looks like.
The United Farm Workers Union celebrated the passage of California's law and is working on actions in New York. I contacted UFW for an interview, and while they declined, I did get an email statement from its Director of Strategic Campaigns, Elizabeth Strader, which read, "For generations, farmers have had a protected right to join a variety of their own organizations. Shouldn't farm workers also have protected rights to join their own organizations?" The California Agriculture Labor Relations Voting Choice Act protects farm workers' rights to join their own organization of their choosing. In today's National Spotlight, the recent USDA Crop Progress Report showed that planting progress is slowing down. Chad Smith has more on why.
Rainfall and wet conditions are slowing planting progress in the U.S. Betty Resnick, an economist with the American Farm Bureau Federation, says a lot of the slowdown is taking place in the Corn Belt.
Nationwide, we're about 3% behind our five-year average for corn planting as of this week and 6% behind last year's progress. Nebraska and Colorado are the furthest behind their averages, followed by Illinois, then Iowa and Kentucky. The Corn Belt is not really seeing immediate relief from this wet weather, and there are some final planting dates coming up for full crop insurance coverage by the end of May.
Resnick says we're still early in the planting season for major concerns, but that important deadlines are approaching.
So there's not any emergency alarms going off yet, but there is reason to be monitoring the wet weather throughout the Midwest. If there's not enough time to put a corn crop in, it could push more corn acres into soybeans, which do have a later planting window.
U.S. agriculture will have more opportunities coming up to keep track of planting progress.
On Friday, we have the May WASDE report, which is the first WASDE report that has information on the 2024-2025 crop year. In addition to providing insights on the 24-25 crop, we'll all be watching what they do with South American supply estimates, especially in light of recent devastating and tragic flooding in southern Brazil, in addition to crop disease issues in Argentina. So you can all check out American Farm Bureau's Market Intel for an analysis.
Learn more at fb.org/marketintel. Chad Smith, Washington.
U.S. ag exports are still facing headwinds. Here's Gary Crawford with more.
Over the last couple of years, U.S. ag exports have faced some headwinds, but have remained above their historical averages. And
we're hoping we're going to have another strong performance with U.S. ag exports this year around the world.
Daniel Whitley runs the USDA's Foreign Agricultural Service. He says exports for the first half of the fiscal year, October through March, are at just under $94.4 billion, 6% below the same time frame a year ago. Whitley says one of those headwinds hampering exports is the strong U.S. dollar, which makes our products more expensive for foreign buyers. But Whitley says that's just one factor. The other one is simply supply and demand.
What we've seen is the South American crop rebounding from three straight years of poor weather. They came and had a historical crop, like a once-in-a-generation crop. And that crop really competed with what we were doing here.
And still is. So U.S. ag exports, again, are running 6% down. Imports, 2% higher than this time a year ago. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Will the 2024 Farm Bill be passed by Congress and signed into law sometime this year? Rod Bain looks for the answer.
A 2024 Farm Bill could just happen in 2024. The question of whether a new farm bill could become law this year is one asked by several stakeholders in the farm and food sectors, such as Mike Strands of the National Farmers Union.
That's a good question, and I think you've probably heard a bunch of different answers to will we see a farm bill this year, and I think it's possible.
An important step to farm bill passage in 2024 was made in both chambers of Congress the first day of May, as both House and Senate Agriculture Committee chairs released their versions of the legislation. Joe Gilson of the American Farm Bureau Federation says on the House side,
Chairman Thompson has said that by Memorial Day, we will have a markup of the bill.
With May 23rd set as the specific date of bill markup in the House Ag Committee. With various partisan and chamber differences among the House and Senate versions of a new farm bill, that could lend itself to growing concerns about passage this year. As Jake Westlin of the National Association of Wheat Growers explains regarding various timelines, such as Congress in session this year.
If you don't see something move in May or June, there's not a lot of legislative days on the calendar after the 4th of July, because you have conventions coming up for each of the parties. You'll have August recess.
And when Congress returns in September, they not only have a new farm bill to consider. Since the existing one-year extension to the 2018 Farm Bill expires at the end of September.
During that same month, you have to also fund the government beyond the end of September. You have your annual appropriations process that will need to resolve itself, or another continuing resolution, what have you. But after that, it's back to campaigning.
That is why some, like NFU's Mike Strands, believes there is possibility of late-in-the-year consideration and or approval of a new Farm Bill.
To be considered in the lame duck session. That's not ideal, but after the election, there'll be a few weeks of legislative time to move must-pass pieces of legislation. Of course, the Farm Bill expires on September 30th. I think now is the best time, or then, after the election, will be a good time to move forward on a new Farm Bill.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's a livestock report with John Harith.
The value of U.S. beef exports in March was the highest since June of 2023 at just under $890 million, according to Dan Hallstrom, president and CEO of the U.S. Meat Export Federation.
I think on the beef side, we're starting to see quite a few markets contributing to this. You know, we have the Caribbean, the Dominican Republic, the Middle East, but we also have relatively big numbers going into some of the larger markets, which even though they're down slightly year on year, Mexico, Korea, and Japan all had relatively solid months. I think you can attribute, especially in Japan and Korea, some of that strength to the rebounding food service sector.
U.S. pork exports in March held strong despite a cooling in leading market Mexico.
But you look at the rest of the world, and the rest of the world more than made that deficit up. You had a very, very big month with Korea, 27,500 tons, up 44%. The Central American region, which is nothing new, continues to rock and roll. They were up 28%. Colombia, down in South America, another market that's had a really good run the last 4 or 5 months, was up almost 40%. And Australia and New Zealand continues to show the strength they've seen the last 3 or 4 months as well, with growth of about 60% up to 8,000 metric tons. So I think the bottom line there is that the diversification model works very well.
March red meat exports brought outstanding per head value at a critical time for U.S. livestock producers.
The pork side, we're at roughly $71 per head contribution, whereas on the beef side, we were over $450 a head. So I think the timing of this couldn't be better. We know that with higher input costs in the supply chain, and specifically for the producers on the farm, it's good to have a little bit of good news on the value side of the meat products.
For more, please visit usmef.org. For the U.S. Meat Export Federation, I'm John Harith.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. With a preview of what you'll be hearing today on AgNet West, here's Farm News Director Brian German.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture is investing $1.3 million in working lands for wildlife initiatives in California. USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service is accepting applications for the 2024 Sage-Grouse Initiative and Western Willow Flycatcher Initiative. The initiatives are being made available through the NRCS Working Lands for Wildlife Partnership and are aimed at supporting farmers and ranchers in conserving habitat for these species on working lands. SGI focuses on enhancing sagebrush habitat by addressing threats such as invading conifers and invasive grasses, while SWFL offers assistance to restore riparian areas on private lands. Eligible producers in specific counties can apply for these initiatives with the application deadline set for May 24th. For more information and to apply, interested individuals can contact their local NRCS Service Center. Global Ag Solutions provider UPL Corp has finalized the acquisition of Corteva Agriscience's Global Mancozeb fungicide business. The acquisition will reportedly bolster UPL Corp's portfolio and leadership in multi-site fungicides, with Corteva granting ownership of its renowned Mancozeb brand and its technology for crop protection in wet conditions. UPL Corp's Chief Marketing Officer Christina Cohen emphasized Mancozeb's critical role in crop protection and global food security. The acquisition is limited to Corteva's Solo Mancozeb formulations, with the company retaining premix formulations. UPL gains access to Corteva's regulatory dossier, data, registrations, and trademarks for Solo Mancozeb products. The company pledges a seamless transition for customers focusing on sustainable crop yields and future-proof food security. USDA's Farm Service Agency is highlighting how their loan programs can support climate-smart agriculture practices, aiding farmers and ranchers in enhancing environmental stewardship. FSA Administrator Zach Ducheneau emphasizes the role of loans in assisting producers to adopt practices like cover cropping and precision agriculture equipment, which capture carbon, improve water management, and enhance soil health. These loans can complement existing programs like the Conservation Reserve Program and crop insurance options. FSA's efforts include streamlining loan processes through online resources like the Loan Assistance Tool and an online loan application, making it easier for producers to access financing. The initiative aims to simplify paperwork, enhance accessibility, and support producers in implementing climate-smart practices effectively. The Farm Bill frameworks from the U.S. House and Senate Ag Committees include specific funding for combating Huanglongbing. Both frameworks continue funding the Emergency Citrus Disease Research and Extension Program at $25 million annually throughout the bill's duration. President and CEO of California Citrus Mutual, Casey Kramer, views this as a significant bipartisan step signaling Congress's support for citrus funding. The $25 million allocation will fund HLB research through USDA's National Institute of Food and Agriculture, overseen by grower representatives from California, Texas, and Florida. The frameworks included other components that will help support the citrus industry, including increased mandatory funding for the Specialty Crop Research Initiative and development of the Specialty Crop Mechanization and Automation Research and Development Program. The Hanson Agricultural Research and Extension Center is hosting a three-day webinar series focusing on the role of trees in climate change resilience. The Trees to the Rescue Solutions for Climate Change webinar series will be held May 14th through the 16th from 4 to 5:30 each day. The first Zoom webinar in the series will feature conversations on improving outcomes of tree growing and forest restoration efforts, along with climate resilience through urban greening. The second webinar features topics like keeping trees healthy from sapling to maturity and dealing with the inevitable threat of exotic and invasive pests. The final webinar in the series will feature a panel discussion about tree advocacy and planning at the local level and a presentation on native tree restoration with partners and the public. More information about the webinar series is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
How NASA and Ag have worked together for decades. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration, more commonly known as NASA, made an appearance at the 2024 Washington Watch event in Washington, D.C. Brad Dorn is the agricultural lead with NASA. He says the two fit together naturally.
NASA's been involved in Earth observations, specifically for agriculture, since the early 70s. And if you include weather, that was our first foray into Earth observations was the early weather satellites. And so really, agriculture's been at the heart of really driving a lot of Earth observations from our satellites and the tools that we have. And it continues today. If you look at our fleet of 28 or so satellites, most of those observations have some relevance to weather, the water cycle, key things that are very important to the producers out there.
Small businesses contribute more to the nation's economy than you might think. Gary Crawford has more.
Well, happy Small Business Week to everyone.
And congratulations to the National Small Business Week Award winners.
At the White House the other day, Vice President Harris and President Biden both welcoming award-winning small business owners from across the country as part of National Small Business Week. And that week would be the 60th time that the president has declared a special week to honor America's small business entrepreneurs, and for good reason, too.
Small business owners are the backbone of America's economy.
40% of the gross domestic product of America, small businesses.
Vice President Harris outlined how the administration has been supporting small businesses by doing things like investing billions of dollars in community banks,
which are the institutions that help provide capital and financial support to small business owners, in particular, those in overlooked and underserved communities, including our rural communities.
Meanwhile, down the street from the White House at the Agriculture Department,
we know in rural America that small businesses are the heart and soul of rural America.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says that's one of many reasons why the administration is doing everything possible to support existing small businesses and to start new ones.
Because we know they're a major job creator. We're excited at USDA to be supportive of small businesses through our regular rural development programs, but also through an initiative where we're expanding processing capacity, initially for meat and poultry, helping literally hundreds of small businesses expand market opportunities. But we're also going to take a look at non-meat and poultry opportunities as well.
Of course, farms are the backbone of many rural communities. The USDA reports that 88% of all U.S. farms are small family farm businesses.
So this is an opportunity to appreciate and acknowledge the important contribution that small businesses make to the American way of life.
In Washington, this is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Brought to you by the Growing Matters Coalition. The Be Sure campaign from the Growing Matters Coalition helps growers protect bees and other wildlife. Today we're talking with Jeff Marvin, the Senior Director of Research and Development for PBI Gordon.
We are talking about the Be Sure campaign, and I was wondering if you could tell us just a little bit about this year's Be Sure campaign.
Sabrina, I think, you know, this year we're focused in on pollinators, and how can all of us have an impact on making sure that these pollinators are safe? Obviously, we rely on their performance to on our table, you know, probably every meal, whether we're eating something, a vegetable, something that we're drinking, right? That all has a direct tie back to these pollinators and making sure that what we do in an industry is not placing an adverse effect on any of those pollinators.
So in spraying crops, how can applicators be good stewards as they're spraying?
So when you're spraying crops, right, I mean, first and foremost is understanding the product, understanding the label. As we all say in the industry, the label is the law. In that label, there are going to be guidelines for how an application should be made, when it should be made. And it's understanding that label. You know, so when I kind of look outside my window now and in Kansas City, and we're expecting some storms to come through here, you know, probably any hour. And it's understanding a label from if I make an application, how quick is that product going to be rain fast? And what I mean by rain fast is you can make an application and that product is going to dry on the surface of the plant. It's going to be taken into the plant versus if you have a storm come through and you're getting some rain, that product is going to wash off the plant and potentially move to an area where you don't want it to. You know, the other area when you're talking about a storm potentially coming through is, you know, what's the wind going to look like at any given time? On most of your labels or on all of your labels, you're going to see a statement in there that says, you know, do not apply if you're expecting wind speeds above 10 to 15 miles per hour. And I think all of us have, you know, seen a good thunderstorm and quite often, you know, the wind speeds exceed that 10 to 15 mile per hour. A lot of times you get some gusts that are, you know, 20, 25 miles per hour. So it's, you know, it's understanding the label and it's understanding the time and point you're in a given day and what that looks like.
So doing these Be Sure interviews, I've talked a lot with people about protecting pollinators and other wildlife while spraying, but how can farmers and applicators ensure that they're keeping themselves safe as well?
Yeah, you know, so first and foremost, right, and again, we go back to the label. The label is going to tell you exactly what type of PPE or protective personal equipment you should be wearing. Some of your labels may range from make sure you're wearing a pair of long pants, a long sleeve shirt. You know, if you're mixing up a sprayer, make sure you have gloves on. Depending on the formulation, it may call for you to wear an apron when you're mixing. So when you look at that label, there is going to be a specific section within that label that's going to tell you exactly what type of personal protection equipment you should be wearing. And it will vary between product to product.
Great. And so, you know, as we every week give everybody so much information, where can they go to either hear this again or read more about this or get more information?
Yeah, so there's a really great site out there. If you're listening to this, and you can go to thegrowingmatters.org/be sure is an excellent source of all of this information and just the opportunity to refresh what we've talked about here and what others are talking about. But yeah, please do go visit that and make sure you're up to standards when you're out there making applications.
Learn more online at growingmatters.org/be sure. A celebration of modern ag is underway at the National Mall. Here's Rod Bain with more.
Now through Wednesday on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., a display and celebration of modern agriculture. This annual event, organized by the Association of Equipment Manufacturers, kicked off Monday with remarks from Agriculture Department Deputy Secretary Sochil Torres Small.
When I think about precision ag, I think about it as being fundamental to confronting challenges. Whether it's taking on drought that we're increasingly starting to see in fields, whether it's driving down the cost of inputs, or whether it's collecting that data and figuring out how to produce a crop that's healthier, that's more productive, and that's going to give a higher value for our farmers.
Almost 50 organizations across the food and farm spectrum have displays of various technologies and discussion opportunities available during the three-day event, with the theme of this year's celebration as the future of food and farming. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. We'll be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. In this week's Almond Matters, brought to you by Valent USA, getting in front of mite populations can help growers avoid challenges later in the season. Brian German reports.
We're joined once again by Todd Burkdahl this morning, Field Market Development Specialist with Valent USA. And now we're here in the first full week of May, and we got a little bit of rain over the weekend. Some areas seemed like they got a fairly significant amount. And so, Todd, let's start there with where some of that rain went and what that means for growers at this point in the season.
Well, you know, water is part of one of the components of the disease triangle, you know, the environment conducive to disease development. So if there wasn't something to prevent the likes of rust and scab and alternaria before this rain, probably be a good idea to get something on as soon as possible, because if not, those three diseases last year were problematic across the board. Certain areas where pressure was a lot higher than others. We saw some, you know, defoliation right up against Holzbrook. So it was not a good year for disease. I know people are trying to curtail their expenses and keep things at a minimum just because of the certain current economic situation. But if you do have a crop, which most people do, the almond crop looks pretty good all over the place, I would say you need to protect that crop. You know, you don't have to spray it 15 times, but after a rain event like this, I think it mandates some type of fungicide application to keep the problems at bay rather than allowing them to take over. So it'd be a good time in the next day or so to get something on if you didn't have any something on before. Well, the other thing is you start to see some mites overwintering females start to show up. Last week, I saw a couple of different flocks where there was definitely, you know, one or two mites per leaf on the interior of the tree. So as they lay eggs, populations tend to be exponential. Get some warm weather, those mite populations will probably explode. So good time to get a pre-explosion biticide on, something that's going to take out the eggs and the nymphs, the early nymphs, and actually sterilize the female. I recommend Zeal, which works really, really well for that. It's an early timing application like this right now. Basically, you can knock them out before they get started. You wait till there's a huge population and you've got to go in there and spray maybe more than one time too. So again, trying to keep the economics of managing the orchard to a minimum. Right now, they tend to put out the lights and the mites before they take over. And then the other thing is too, when there's this disease thing, this rain was significant. We got I'm in Visalia right now, and it was registered 0.3 inches from the nearest weather station, but my rain gauge is still almost 0.5 inch. So I don't know which more accurate, but anyway, it was a significant event. Things are wet, canopy was wet, sage wet. So I'm looking at almonds this morning that have rust pustules on them already. They had it on before the rain. This rain's going to exacerbate that, probably going to explode without some type of preventative. And they said rust last year was very problematic in certain areas. And just north of me here, it's looking at leaves right now, but quite a bit of rust on the leaves already. So anyway, that's it in a nutshell. So no pun intended.
And with that rain that came in and some cooler temperatures to start out the week, that's helpful to maybe get in front of mites, right? Because we've got some warm days ahead of us, and that's when things could really be a problem, right?
Exactly. These females that are, you know, overwintering females, we had basically a pretty mild winter. There wasn't we didn't have any freezing, you know, temperatures per se. No freezing kill for the mites and whatnot. But over winter, those females will be laying eggs. They're already laid eggs. Those nymphs will hatch, and as the temperature increases, those populations will, like I said, it will be exponential growth. So anyway, getting on right now is in the early stages, taking out the eggs, taking out those first stage nymphs will be an advantage in overall preventative control of the population going into the season. Granted, there's several factors that weigh into that, but I think heat is one of the bigger things. You know, you got to have temperature to drive their biology, and we have that coming. So.
Yeah, I believe the forecast is showing some areas expected to hit around 90 degrees by the weekend. And once those temperatures climb, that's when, if you're not in front of things, you could be behind at that point and looking at maybe a bigger challenge.
Exactly. Yeah. Again, I can't, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. You've heard that from me before. It's the name of the game when you've got, you know, all the pieces of the puzzle coming together. So. I mean, I don't want to scare anybody, but that's the fact. Mites can exponentially, from one week to another, it's like, what happened? Where did these come from? They were there. You just didn't see them. The eggs were, you know, hatching all at once. And then the heat amplified the biology. And so they took off like a rocket sled on rails. And then you got mites everywhere.
That was Brian German with this week's Almond Matters. You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. Now for more news. There is a great deal of banter within the agricultural trade about potential corn yield losses should rain delays push planting into late May. Todd Gleason reports.
The rainfall events this year have caused many to think about late planted corn and what yield impact it might have for the 2024 growing season. As it happens, University of Illinois agricultural economist Scott Irwin began to work last fall on a weather model that incorporates a late planting yield penalty. He wrote an article for the Farm Doc Daily website, and you may read it online at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. I asked Scott why he decided to put the weather model together.
There's kind of a quick and dirty way to approach some of these questions, like the trend yield on corn and soybeans and impacts of crop conditions, different weather. And it's okay as a first step to estimate these effects one by one. But we know that in truth, the right way to do it is you have to allow all these impacts to affect one another simultaneously. And that's why I knew I needed to finally bite the bullet. And I started last fall estimating what we call a crop weather model that includes all the important drivers in one model, and they're all working at the same time.
And so this model includes precipitation, even in the months, well, maybe it's a precipitator. I don't know whether it's precipitation from September to March. So the weather when generally there is not a crop in the ground or it's not growing anymore. And then there's precipitation models for April and June and August, and temperature models for May and June and July and August. And they're all weighted. We won't go through the weights, but I do want to go through what the yield trend line yield you come up with when you use this model might be, because it is higher than what most might think of as the trend line yield.
You know, most of the time to get a trend line yield, we'll just run a straight line through a graph of yield versus time. And that's okay. There's a place for that. But we know that you can get a bias doing that because you're not at the same time conditioning on the weather. This is a big debate that's going on right now that, for example, since 2013, you know, if you just look at a plot of corn yields, it looks like the rate of growth in trend yields for U.S. corn have slowed down the last decade. But is the rate of genetic improvement and management improvement in corn in the U.S. really slowing down? Or could this be explained by just a run of poorer than average weather? The model I use says it's all poorer than average weather. And so the trend hasn't really changed over the entire period that I estimate the model, which I start in 1980.
And then to deal with late planting, in the first 5 years, you say late planting starts at May 30, and then from that point on, it's May 20. However, when you deal with this late planting, you come up with and this is surprising to me, a single number for every percentage of late planting that takes place. It's 0.35, or about 3.5 tenths of a bushel,
right,
per percent, correct?
That is correct. And so there's different ways to do this, and the USDA's model that they use does it a little bit differently. This goes way back to work that I did 15 years or more ago with Daryl Good, when we really think that the best way to reflect late planting in a model like this is what we call a cutoff variable. In other words, we know from the great work that our friends in agronomy do in terms of their field trial experiments to pin down optimal planting dates for corn, that sometime after about the 15th or 20th of May, you really start to hit the big penalties. And so we experimented years ago with various cutoff dates, and this sequence seems to fit the data the best. And so right now, any percentage of the corn crop planted after May 20th takes a, as you said, 0.35 bushels per acre hit.
So if I were to just want to use this model or the 0.35, could I take the weekly crop progress report after May 20th and start to apply it?
Absolutely. You could. I have examples in the article of how you could do that. For example, the trend yield that this model predicts for 2024 for U.S. average corn yield is 182.1 bushels per acre. Let's say you get to May 20th and the amount that's planted late is 28%, which is 10 percentage points higher than average. On average, we plant 18% of the crop past that date. It's very hard to get it all planted in the optimal window. And so since the 182.1 assumes average late planting, then it's the margin above or below average that would be used to adjust the 182.1. So in this case, if it came out at 28%, you're 10 points above normal, then you just take 10 times minus 0.35 or minus 3.5 bushels, and then you would just subtract the 3.5 bushels from the 182.1. I think that's 178.6. And then that's how you would do it. Of course, you know, right now people are looking at, you know, well, what kind of projection for late planting makes sense? You know, will it be 28%? Will it be 35%, 50%, or maybe it'll be average? That's a really difficult thing to project at this point in time, because there's 22 days between May 20th and our last observation on planting progress in the U.S. And that's a long time to try to project what late planting is going to be. I mean, the weather, as we know, can turn on a dime.
we could still have a normal planting season, or we could have a really terrible planting season, more towards like 2019 or 2022.
Okay, anything I didn't ask you that I should have?
I would just say at this point, despite how wet it is in Illinois, and it's wet right now, I think we have to be cautious about predicting a historical level of late planting like we had in 2019. It's just too early and too much can happen.
Scott Irwin is an agricultural economist on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois, a member of the Farm Dog team. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.